Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, why development finance needs a national rethink. The G20's credibility crisis. Can global governance survive elitism? Forget being an astronaut or a chief executive officer. Here's what your child actually needs to succeed. And how South African solar technology could change the world. It's Tuesday, the 24th of June. Now, as the world moves beyond the old model of donor aid, a new development finance approach I see is starting to take shape, one that is possibly more inclusive. It's a little more coordinated and country-led. At the heart of the shift is the idea of something called country platforms, essentially nationally owned multi-stakeholder frameworks designed to mobilize and align both public and private capital for sustainable development. All very well and good, but can they really replace traditional aid? And are countries like South Africa, our country, ready to lead this charge? I'm in conversation now with Professor Richard Calland, political writer and commentator, and also visiting professor at the Wits School of Governance. Richard, a very warm welcome. You describe the world as entering something called a post-aid era. What exactly do you mean by that, and why at this particular juncture?
Yeah, thank you, Jeremy. Look, this is a very timely discussion. In a couple of weeks' time, there is a very important meeting in Seville in Spain, which is a meeting that takes place only every 10 years, which brings together the world's development agencies and with the intention of working out what's the grand plan for development aid. So this conversation is very important, very timely. And the two dimensions to this notion of a post-aid world, one is the simple and rather brutish reality of a Trump administration that is pulling back from American responsibilities around the world and cutting US aid budgets and so on. That's one aspect of it. And that's having a ripple effect through UN agencies as well as just US aid projects that are hurting people as a result of those cuts. The second is a recognition that the old development aid paradigm is kind of fatigued, it's tired. The idea that there's a bunch of kind of rich developed countries who must now pay for development in underdeveloped, poor countries with a very top-down approach is really, I think now, it's beyond kind of strategic value, if I can put it in those terms. And so there's a search now for a better way of organizing finance.
Why has that strategic value in the old model been lost?
I think partly because countries in the global south have become more assertive. They've become more confident. They're also richer. Or less poor than they used to be. And countries like India, to cite one very obvious example, is no longer a poor country. It has extraordinary development rates. It's now close to being the size of Japan in terms of its economy. But even more obviously, low development countries like Kenya have really improved in terms of many of their metrics. They face huge challenges still. Let's not kid ourselves, but they're more assertive. And I think the idea that rich countries know all the answers and will come in with money and say, this is the way to fix your economy, this is the way to transition out of carbon intensive energy and so on, that's really no longer tolerable. And so a more strategic alignment is needed.
So you have this notion called country platforms. How does that differ from the traditional donor model that you've been explaining to me?
So you're asking exactly the right question, and it may turn out that it's a mirage, that it doesn't really shift the paradigm, doesn't make the difference that's required. If it does, however, succeed, it will be because of, I think, at least two things. Firstly, it will be truly country-owned in the sense that country X, who is the recipient of the development aid, will set the agenda rather than the other way around. Secondly, a more technical point, but a very important one, is that the investment priorities will be set by that recipient country first. They will say, for example, like Egypt has done with its country platform, we want to shift our economy through big changes in agriculture, energy, and water. Those are the big levers, and therefore we have very big plans for those three things, but we're short of finance. Who would like to come in and help finance these things in a way that's good for us, but also good for the world? And that's the conversation that's kind of happening. And so that project planning, which in the past was kind of countries had to do it hoping they would then get money. Now they will get money for developing the project pipeline and the actual ideas from the get-go.
But in practical terms, Richard, difficult surely to align competing interests of governments, investors, and development partners. It's all down to how this is marshaled.
Well, indeed. And the South Africa's own experience with our so-called JETP, the Just Energy Transition Partnership, which was announced, if you remember, at the COP annual climate change negotiation meeting in Glasgow some 4 years ago. $8.5 billion to come to support South Africa's transition away from coal towards renewable energy. That has worked to some extent. It's also been a disappointment to some extent. Big lessons have been learned about sequencing, about the terms and conditions of finance, and so on. But what's really important is that all the relevant stakeholders are involved in the conversation. So choreographing the governance and the decision-making around it is going to be critical to the legitimacy and the effectiveness of a country platform.
And underpinning this, Richard, you say it's critical for deep political reform to take place to make the platform work. Practically, what would that reform actually look like?
Well, I think you've got to have capability in the state because this is state-led. This is not, yes, there'll be private finance, there'll be private sector actors involved, both in the planning, the financing, and the execution of the projects. But it's got to be state-led. And so that requires, as a minimum requirement, a capability within the state, which is often absent or is distorted by corruption or rent-seeking. So cleaning up the governance, building the leadership and project capabilities in the state is going to be an important part of this. So the Green Climate Fund, for example, has ramped up its so-called Climate Finance Readiness Fund, giving $7 million a year to each of the 54 countries on the African continent in order for them to ready themselves for this kind of development assistance.
Capability is one thing, but the argument is also predicated on trust. And we know that trust is often in very short supply.
It's in huge short supply at the moment, and it's in short supply, particularly in relation to climate finance. Copenhagen, years ago, 2009, the disaster of that climate negotiation, in the ashes of Copenhagen, world leaders agreed to $100 billion a year per country, for developing countries by 2020. And that never came, and we're still searching for that mythical figure. And that has distorted trust. It's undermined confidence. And yet everybody knows that finance is essential to investing in the infrastructure needed to deal with climate overshoot, to deal with getting out of carbon as quickly as possible, and so on.
So, Richard, if I've read this correctly, South Africa is being put forward as a potential test case. But the reality of our current political and institutional setups don't really support the model unless we can make changes very quickly. What would those immediate changes need to be in order to make the model work more effectively?
Well, South Africa is already a test case. It was a pioneer in this regard. And the JETP, the Just Energy Transition, is regarded as a really important guinea pig for how to do this, but also lessons learned how not to do it. For example, the sequencing was wrong. So big investments in closing coal power stations, building up renewable energy. But the transmission grid necessary to move renewable energy around the country was not yet in place. So that's an important lesson. Get your sequencing right. Secondly, as you say, the political economy is treacherous, to put it mildly. The vested interests in coal are really difficult. So you need a political pact to underpin the more technical aspects of the development aid deal.
I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. That's Professor Richard Calland, a political writer, commentator, also visiting professor at the Wits School of Governance here in Gauteng. Richard, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday. for all your up-to-date stories.
The G20 bills itself as a forum for global cooperation, but some critics say it's become too elite, it's become too exclusive and possibly even too disconnected from people it claims to serve. So as it prepares to meet in South Africa later this year, important questions are mounting about whether this club of powerful economies still reflects the interests of the broader international community. With me now is Professor Daniel Bradlow, international law expert at the University of Pretoria. I want to discuss how the G20 could become more inclusive, accountable and effective. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. And in your opinion then, what's the core problem with the G20 as it currently functions?
So thanks for inviting me. The problem with the G20 is it's supposedly 20 nations. It's actually 19 countries plus the EU and the African Union. So it's a little bit bigger. The problem is there are 193 countries roughly in the world. And most of them have an interest on what's the G20 agenda, but they have no real way of having an impact or influence on what's happening. And so that there's the question as to why the 20 countries in the G20 have the authority that they do to make the decisions that they do without consulting other countries in the world as well.
So if those countries that are excluded have no impact at all, what is the consequence? What's the meaning of that?
So the thing with the G20 is it has no authority. It's a self-appointed group of countries. It's an informal gathering, but it includes most of the big, not all, but most of the big economies in the world. And so that if it makes a decision, that decision can have an impact on the way the world, the global economy, for example, functions. So, for example, during the global financial crisis, the G20 was the place where decisions were made on how to manage the crisis. More recently, the reform agenda for the multilateral development banks, so the World Bank, the African Development Bank, banks like that, have been made starting in the G20, and then from there, those decisions are taken into the organizations, but they're already a pre-cooked decision in effect. So without everybody being able to participate fairly in that decision.
So in that respect, then, is it possible to expand the G20? Would that do anything to its efficiency or maybe even negate any improvement in legitimacy and impact?
I mean, the problem is that to make decisions, you can't have every 190. We know from the UN, from other forums like that, that if you have 193 countries all in the room together, plus all the international economic organizations that you need, the meeting's just too big to have a really good discussion and make a decision. So I think it's how do we sort of balance the need for efficiency and decision making with the need to make sure that it's as representative as possible. And that's why Professor Robert Wade and I came up with the idea that the G20 should learn from what the Financial Stability Board has done, which is to create regional organizations and to require some of the G20 members to consult with those regional organizations so that they can bring the concerns of those regions into the G20. So, for example, South Africa could form a regional group with the African continent and have a regular meeting where they could talk to Africa about the issues on the G20 agenda, the concerns of African countries, and then take the outcomes of those meetings back into the G20. And I think that would both make it more representative or more responsive to the concerns of Africa in this example, but it would also increase the credibility of the South African voice, because when it says it speaks for Africa, it actually has a basis for saying what Africa wants. Mm.
Professor, I suppose that argument is predicated on whether there's any appetite within the G20 itself for reform, or would you think that members are maybe just a little too comfortable with the current setup?
I think that there's a question as to whether there's appetite for reform. I wouldn't say it's because they're too comfortable. I think the tensions in the G20 have become much more profound because of the war in Ukraine, because of the situation in Gaza, the US, as we saw in the G7, where President Trump left in the middle of the meeting. There's concerns, do they want to actually continue the G20 as a forum for making decisions in the world on global governance issues? And that's not a completely clear answer at this point.
So South Africa, as I mentioned at the start of this conversation, hosts the G20 this year. Is there anything that Pretoria can do to move the needle, to lead by example, do you think?
We've got a tough assignment. I think there is things that we can do. They could form a regional grouping. And in a way, as you know, the president has appointed an African expert panel chaired by Trevor Manuel to talk about issues on Africa's concerns about the global economy. And that report could be almost like a model for how to do things in a regional consultative way, because it's got members on that from the African continent. The problem is it's not representative of governments, it's individuals on that. So that is not a perfect example, but South Africa, by consulting more with Africa, by working more with the African Union, which is now part of the G20, can say that, you know, this is a model of how we can become, we the G20 can become a more representative body and more responsive to the concerns of particularly developing countries in the G20. Mm.
And just a final one, if nothing changes, and one senses that's probably going to be the case, what is at stake for the G20 short to medium term credibility, its future?
So it's a big question, because this year is an important year. It's the last in a cycle of developing countries chairing the G20. Next year, if the cycle continues as scheduled, the United States becomes the chair of the G20. So given the current situation in the world and in the US, if this year doesn't go well, then the chances of that the US will, or the risk that things start going wrong while the US is the chair, probably go up. And so the credibility of the G20 will take a hit, and its efficacy in dealing with global problems will be reduced.
Professor Daniel Bradlow, Center for the Advancement of Scholarship at the University of Pretoria, thank you very much for joining me today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, in an economy where just over 32% of South Africans are unemployed and over 45% of youth have simply no job prospects, many parents are still clinging to outdated career advice. But as artificial intelligence, climate change, and rapid digitization reshape the world of work, how do we guide our children towards more purpose-driven, future-proof careers? In that respect, I want to talk to Spiwe Masuku from the education finance company Fundi, and hopefully with a clear message that we need to radically rethink what success actually looks like. So Spiwe, a very warm welcome to you. Why are so many graduates, in your opinion, struggling to find work? And what does it say these days about the kind of qualifications that we are encouraging young people to pursue?
Hello, Jeremy, and to your listeners. Thank you for having me. Please allow me a second to just mention that Fundi is formerly EdgeLoan. We have been in existence for over 25 years, and we are in the business of enabling education dreams. So back to your question, we have the opportunity to be exposed and talk to students and to have engagements with them, run surveys and all of that. And the key thing that has come up often is that our generation is actually still choosing careers based on financial return. Some of them are choosing careers because of, you know, it's what I only know. I don't have much information about what else is there. But these choices that we are making are actually not addressing what the future market looks like.
Which says to me that South Africa's education system is badly misaligned when it comes to the demands of today and tomorrow's job market.
So to your point, I'd say it actually starts at home with you and I as a parent or as a sibling or a brother and uncle, right? So we don't have these conversations enough. That's why we also identify that there's almost nothing or lack of information about career guidance. We don't have the conversations about what do you want to solve in the future? What problems have you identified as a kid or as a teenager that you want to participate and make an impact? We are not talking about passion and purpose, right? What we are passionate about so that we can turn this passion into a skill. So Not only is this in a formal class where it needs to be addressed, but you and I need to take the lead at home and start the conversations.
And you make the point about purpose-driven career guidance. So what does that actually mean, and how does it differ from the traditional subject-based school counseling that people are more familiar with?
So traditionally, if you think about it, you would choose a career based on financial return, right? Because you want the money. But if the purpose is not there and your passion is not aligned to what you are choosing, there's a lot that happens in any job, in a 9-to-5. And you find that there's a lot of fatigue. There's a lot of depressed employees in corporates. They can't handle the pressure because there's that passion that is missing in what they do. It's not actually what they would love to wake up and do every day. It's actually what they are forced to do for the financial return. So that is where the purpose-driven career comes in, to say, look at what you love and the impact that you want to do, and actually look at what careers are aligned with who you are as a person and what you love.
I absolutely accept that observation, but I would suggest to you that financial return is also critical to the equation, surely.
It is very critical. However, it becomes very challenging, socially so, because if you have employees in the workforce who are mostly depressed and who can't show up at work, the production, you know, return is very minimal. The no-shows are a lot. And if you're talking about students per se who are pursuing a course that they are not liking, we have a lot of dropouts, students. Or once they've graduated, they are not looking for the job because they don't know what this thing is. It is not speaking to them. It's not aligning with them.
So what, in your opinion, then, are the top emerging sectors that South Africans should be aware of, and whether schools are preparing learners sufficiently for those sectors?
So there's quite a few of them. I mean, all of us know of this AI. So let me make an example of ChatGPT, right? So a lot of us are using ChatGPT, but we aren't thinking about, actually, with the emergence of ChatGPT and AI, what are roles that have been emerging with this? Because everything that is born will have people that will have to service it, if I may put it that way, in simple terms. So have you thought about becoming an AI trainer, you know, going into schools and teaching these kids not only to extract information from the platform, but also learn the platform enough to educate the next person? Because now we are now wiring ourselves to thinking entrepreneurship. You are taking initiative to do something that will in turn become a job, because a 9-to-5 only in this day is no longer defined as a career. We have side hustles that are built into it to substitute the financial return. Obviously, speaking of, these are some of the things that we love doing.
Just finally, then, it's difficult in this new paradigm to instill transferable skills and adaptability, particularly within a rigid schooling system that is also built around fixed exams. It's a complete paradigm or mind shift change that is needed. Are you confident that can happen?
Yes, very confident. However, we as parents need to be vocal about it. We need to start challenging the status quo of what the system looks like. And we also need to shift our minds from thinking that that primary school that you attended is the same school that your child needs to attend. So I'll make an example. There are people who are independently passionate about education and they are teaching differently. So they are incorporating skills. They are incorporating the fact that not every child has the same capacity in class. So they are using methods such as, you know, soft skills. You know, there's a lot of activities that are happening so that they can enhance, you know, your child's performance and reach to what they are capable to achieve. So we need to look at those ones and not say, because she's running the school in a small unit, this thing is not going to be beneficial for my child. We need to explore those opportunities. And when we do that, that's when we start identify what our children need and what we think they must go through.
Well, a lot of food for thought there as we look at future-proofing careers in a rapidly shifting job market. From Fundi, Spiwe Masuku, thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The global race to expand solar energy is heating up, but while installation capacity surges, the design of large-scale solar farms remains painfully slow and possibly even inefficient. That's until now. Now, South African company 7 Second Solar, led by Chief Executive Officer Paul Nell, claims to have found a game-changing solution. Their software, it's called AutoPV, promises to compress months of engineering work into hours, and that would enable smarter, faster solar deployment. But my question, can this innovation really and truly shift the dial? So, Paul, a very warm welcome to you. Global solar capacity, as I've mentioned, is growing fast, but often the design process isn't. So maybe let's start here. Why is utility-scale solar development still so sluggish and, I imagine, resource-intensive?
Good day, Jeremy. Yes, it is a complicated process to design large utility-scale projects. People might think it's, you know, as easy as copy and paste or click and drag because it's so much repetition, right? So that's not the case. You know, for large projects like we see in the Northern Cape, Katu, Daro, those areas, which is in the region of about, let's say, 100 megawatts in capacity. It can take an engineering firm up to 6 months to do that design. It's complicated. It's a lot of repetitive work, but it is hard, and there's a lot of real engineering that goes into that. And typically, traditional engineering is just, you know, normal CAD drawings and spreadsheets, and it's very error-prone. It takes a lot of time, a lot of work. So it's just something that has not really been addressed through automation, and that's where we've kind of found a little bit of a niche and started looking at ways to automate, accelerate that entire process.
Well, let's look at that process in just a moment, but as it exists at the moment, you've also spoken about design bottlenecks, and I would imagine this impacts negatively on cost, risk, and probably most importantly, the timeline of getting solar farms from blueprint to the actual grid, which is critical.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Jeremy. So one of the biggest problems we face with designing solar PV farms, the large ones, is that because it's so labor intensive and takes such a long time, there's a lot of things that do not happen. So, you know, I like to say that every megawatt is always only designed once, but it should really be optimized and iterated through various designs to get the best solution, right? So at the moment, we just get a solution. We don't know if it's the best solution. And that certainly leads to possible cost overruns, time delays on project execution. And eventually, we just don't end up with the best possible project.
So we know that, Paul, South Africa has huge solar potential. I mean, that's a given. But we also know that so few projects reach scale quickly. What specifically is holding us back? Is it a policy issue? I don't think it would be a talent pipeline, but maybe a degree of investor caution, maybe something else. What do you think it is?
South Africa is very rich in solar resource. One of the best in the world, really, especially if you look up the Northern Cape region. Our problem is largely access to grid in South Africa. I think our government's policies have largely been fairly accommodating, and we've seen a lot of growth in the renewable energy space in South Africa, hugely encouraging. But for us, the problem through the Northern Cape especially is just connecting to the grid. It's not a problem unique to South Africa. This is something you'll find through most areas in the world where solar is prevalent. It really is grid access. That's one of our biggest problems. And I think our policy have been very accommodating over the last few years, and government's really coming to that party.
Well, that is good news. And against that backdrop, then, you've developed the software which you say is going to compress months of engineering work into hours. The benefits are obviously fairly self-explanatory, but how does this innovation work, and do you really think you're going to move the needle?
Yeah, absolutely, Jeremy. So the software we've developed is a cloud-based design platform specifically aimed at releasing this bottleneck of getting designs through faster than what they are coming through at the moment. And we've had significant success already. We've some of the projects that we've designed are already under construction in South Africa. We've been taking the product overseas through various conferences and very positive reception. And I think it's addressing a real pain point for engineering firms. They spend a lot of time doing things they don't enjoy. They should be spending time doing value engineering, trying to optimize designs, finding better solutions. And our tool certainly allows them to do that.
So how do you take the concept that you have right now to something that resembles useful scale?
So for us, the concept of scale is really built into the way that the product is being developed. It's a cloud-based product. It's a web interface. It's really actually quite straightforward to design the solar plant using our platform, our tools. And also that allows more people to get involved on the design process. You don't necessarily have to be a CAD specialist or an engineer with 15 projects on your CV. It's really opening up and making it more accessible to do proper design work, not something that's on the back of a cigarette box, but real proper design that can go into construction.
Do you think that the industry values the kind of iteration that you're presenting and the optimization when it comes to major infrastructure investments sufficiently? In other words, or maybe more simply, is there a real excitement and appetite for something like this?
Yeah, no, absolutely, Jeremy. So we recently did a project for a client. It's a large 200 megawatt project. It's really a big project. We helped them do 8 different designs, construction-ready designs, to evaluate the impact of some small changes on design assumptions. And we found $1 million of saving just in cable cost through those 8 iterations. Now, typically, if you were doing this traditionally, it would take you maybe 4 months to get to that level with 8 different designs. We did it in the morning. So I think industry is ready. They do see that benefit. And the cost saving is just so obvious.
Paul Nell, thank you very much indeed, Chief Executive Officer at 7 Second Solar. I appreciate your time. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.